Well, that's actually a very good take.
It's very interesting because he like in some ways, like he is like he loves being human because he has all these emotions and he thinks about this. Like he meets a woman that he loves and he thinks about the family that they're gonna have and all of this stuff. And he doesn't want to become a Time Lord. He doesn't want to lose his emotions and his feelings. But you see, like as soon as he makes that decision to go back to being a Time Lord, that's when he's like truly effective in being able to like save people.
Mm-hmm. Ooh, wait till you get to a new season.
It's a very good show. Okay.
So this is what we've been studying. Basically, we're down here where it says no scope. And the whole point is to get up here. And we've been going through each of the steps that need to be attained to be able to achieve enlightenment, according to most of the Tibetan teachers. So the idea is that one of the biggest problems that we have is that there's a very bad... We lack the understanding of the differentiation between what a realization is at an intellectual level in a contrived way and a realization that is uncontrived. And because we don't take the time to make a distinction between those two words, those two states of mind, the normal practitioner can fall into believing that they've achieved great attainments when they really have not. And that doesn't sound like that big of a deal, but the problem it generates is that in the moment a student is convinced that they've attained something, when the attainment actually shows up, they don't recognize it. And that happens to a lot of meditators, for example, in the West. They've been to different types of classes that explain meditation in terms of some of the results that are secondary, that are not really the purpose of meditation. And the big problem with meditation is that in some stages, some of the side effects are very pleasant. And if we don't have detachment of those, we're just going to stay there and keep enlarging the pleasure that these states of mind give us, not understanding that we're just stagnant and we're not moving forward. Mm-hmm. So using the analogy of meditation, what we're doing on the last two classes and probably the next two classes is painting a picture of what needs to be done to achieve enlightenment according to the Tibetans. And to do that, we're going in a very generic way through every single thing that needs to be attained. So normally one starts being non-scope. And non-scope means that you can study a lot and you have a tendency to like spiritual things and maybe you do yoga or you like shamans or whatever. No? So there's an inquisitive mind at play. One of the big problems of that stage is that unless we focus on one thing properly, we can stay there forever. Because there will always be a new teacher, and there will always be a new way of seeing things, and there will always be a new technique, and reflexology, and Ayurvedic blah blah blah. And so when we fall into that type of system, then our spiritual path becomes our distraction. And then we get stagnant there. And the big enemy in any spiritual path is to become stagnant. So to leave the non-scope setup, there's two things that have to happen. Normally, we start meditating a lot on decay, basically impermanence. And as we do that, the more we do something, the more the neural pathways will align themselves in terms of that state of mind that we are accepting. Basically, the way we are right now is a collection of neural pathways set up in a specific way. a drug addict has their neural pathway set up in a different way. At the end of the day, we're not that different than the drug addict, because we get to, all those neural pathways are set up in terms of the things we like and the things we're trying not to experience because we don't like them. So a drug addict is easier to understand in those terms because he's looking for a specific type of happiness that's given to him by drugs. A more normal person does exactly the same way in terms of love or friendship or work or many other things. As a person starts studying any type of philosophy, the neural pathways, because of repetition mainly, not because you understand anything, it's just because you're repeating it to yourself enough, you brainwash yourself into believing this new idea, because the neural pathways get realigned in terms of that repetition. See? So at the end of the day, it's not that something is correct. It's just that, like when you tell yourself a lie enough times that it becomes the truth, it's because there's an alignment of neural pathways. And that is what any spiritual path is at the non-scope period. We keep working in terms of ideas that we like and how we implement those ideas to change our world in terms of things we like. We have not developed any sincere type of detachment. We have not developed any sincere type of renunciation. No? So what happens then is that to be able to work in terms of that, the path is set up so that we utilize the way our neural pathways function. So through the whole non-scope period, the main teachings are in terms of impermanence and death, so that out of repetition we trigger an uncontrived realization of impermanence and death. That means that we're thinking about our impermanence so much that we get to convince ourselves that life is short and we need to take advantage of all our opportunities to such a degree that eventually we have a non-conceptual understanding of that through a more permanent realignment of neural pathways that from that point on allows us to experience every single activity that we engage in with an undertone of impermanence. So we cook for somebody and we understand impermanence. Like that. In the moment we get that uncontrived realization of death and impermanence, we jump to the first scope. And in the first scope, we work with the different ideas and meditations in terms of detachment. And the idea is to generate a state of mind that will take us to be very afraid of a lower rebirth. And this is a very problematic stage because Westerners don't believe really, even Buddhists, Westerners, have a very hard time believing in past lives. And even when they understand it logically and they try to believe it, to believe in lower realms, well, the animal realm we can see, but then the ghost realm and the hell realms are things that, I mean, we don't study Catholicism so that we don't have to deal with those things. So there's an inherent problem there. Because without the fear of a lower rebirth, the renunciation necessary to do all the work that we're doing in terms of having a positive next lifetime doesn't happen. And without that state of mind, we cannot practice the first scope. And normally you go to some debates and people are like, well, my practice is not about fearing things. I don't believe in that. But Buddhism is structured to deal with this and to go through emotions and understand emotions in a very specific way. And fear is where one has to start to be able to understand renunciation. So through the whole first scope, you deal with these fears to understand renunciation, and eventually the neural pathways out of repetition get rearranged again to the point where a non-contrived realization of renunciation happens. This means that after that state of mind that happens normally in meditation, although it can happen in everyday life, but it will take a meditational type of scenario, we get into the third scope once we have that uncontrived realization of impermanence, which means that from that moment on, we brainwash ourselves enough that physically our neural pathways have lined up in such a way that we have an undertone of renunciation in everything we do. This is a very important stage, because at this moment, because you have renunciation, you can take refuge for the first time properly. Because you are not going to be taking refuge on all those things you're renunciating about. So a better job will not be an object of refuge. The partner will not be an object of refuge. All these external things will not be objects of refuge, because we'll have renunciation, which to a large degree comes to be or happens out of a combination of understanding karma and emptiness to some degree. But mainly we understand karma and emptiness, not necessarily in a philosophical way that directly karma and emptiness. Instead, we do it out of understanding that through experience, that a lot of those things where we normally put our happiness on have collapsed and have not given us that happiness. So it's an experiential thing that's allowing us to have a philosophical understanding based on our own personal experience. So at that moment, then, we become a third scope practitioner. A second scope practitioner. And then we have we start working in terms of compassion. And this doesn't mean that we haven't been working in terms of compassion before, but we start working a lot in terms of compassion to develop bodhicitta. Or at least a strong flavor of bodhicitta. And eventually we're going to get a specific type of realization of bodhicitta that will take us into the third scope. And in the third scope, we're going to start dealing with emptiness until we brainwash ourselves to have an uncontrived realization of emptiness. And for our school of Buddhism, this is where something radical happens. Because that uncontrived realization works exactly like all the other uncontrived realizations. But the beauty of uncontrived realizations is that when they happen, and we've had millions of uncontrived realizations, it's those moments where you actually get something. Where you're not really thinking about it, where there isn't maybe this or maybe that, where you actually understand something inherently. And at this point, we experience emptiness directly, which has a series of events that happen with it. And that brings us into a state of mind called the first boon. And what did we say happens in the first boon? Melissa, since you're the only one that was here last class, all on you.
We work on the perfection of generosity.
Yes.
In perfecting it, because we've seen emptiness directly, we can infuse our generosity with that.
Well, in Buddhism, there's a difference between giving, for example, and the perfection of giving. The perfection implies that certain uncontrived realizations have been attained to allow us to experience giving in a very specific way. In a way where we're not attached to whatever is being given. In a way where we're not expecting anything out of that interaction. Until then, before we see emptiness directly, we're always giving in a philosophical way. Again, it's not uncontrived. It's not, oh, you're cold, have my sweater. Just immediately. Without having to think even for a millisecond, what if I'm cold later? Or I hope she gives it back, or stuff like that. No? The first boom is called the very joyous. The second boom is called the stainless. And what happens in the stainless?
We work on perfecting our morality.
So it's again, we've been dealing with morality all along. I mean, we do it every day. But in this level, we are working with the perfection of morality, which is a morality that's based on an understanding of emptiness and karma, to a non-contrived, with a non-contrived undertone of impermanence, of bodhicitta, of renunciation, and of emptiness that allows us to experience things in a very specific way. Then we go to the third bhumi, which is called the luminous. And what happens in the third bhumi?
We work on the perfection of equanimity.
Mm-hmm. And which basically every time we say we are working on these perfections in these levels, it means that we don't have those perfections before. And this takes us back to this problem that we were talking about of people that misunderstand where they are in the path. Oh, because I've been really equanimous lately to my friends, I start believing that I'm actually equanimous. But the best way of gauging where we are is by putting, how do we behave when we are in a really bad situation? When we are very angry? Because anger is very interesting. I mean, we talk in the meditation, in terms of meditations, about single-pointed concentration. We do have single-pointed concentration. The problem is that we're not controlling it. When we're angry, really angry, it's very hard to think about something else. See, in anger, in emotion, we have single-pointed concentration. I mean, think about orgasm. It's a type of single-pointed concentration for how long it lasts, see? The same with anger, the same with jealousy, see? That is why the Dalai Lama in that text says that to get the uncontrived realizations, certain emotions have to be subdued to a certain degree for you to be able to actually work non-philosophically, without attachment, without looking for a result in terms of what you're doing, to be able to experience, to have those neural links set up themselves for the result of an uncontrived realization. See? So then that's what we've been talking about in the last two classes. So today we're going to continue the bhumis. The fourth bhumi is called the radiant. And have you ever seen a stupa?
Yeah.
If you remember, the top of the stupa normally has kind of like a something that has 10 levels up to some object, normally, or a gnom sometimes, or just a little spike, or, and those 10 objects, they're normally cylinders that are decreasing in size, making kind of like a cylindrical cone on top of a stupa. Well, those are representations of these bhumis. And the top of the stupa is enlightenment. And all the bottom aspects of the stupa, the actual architecture of it, are all these levels that we just talked about. Some stupas are less generic than other ones, and each of the sub-levels that you see, every level of detail that goes along the whole thing, is then a specific conceptual understanding that needs to be attained in terms of that. In December, I was in Indonesia, and I had the opportunity to go to Yogyakarta, where they have one of the two only mandalas left in the world, built mandalas. And it's a mandala that, as you ascend, it has the story of the Buddha. And it's really interesting because it's been done in a way that they're not meditation facilities. They're really didactic universities. Like with every religion, I was having a discussion with somebody yesterday, a friend of mine that's a PhD in theology. And we kind of bodied up to debate with this other person. And the whole debate was in terms of the Bible, you know, and how the extreme orthodoxy, like evangelical orthodoxy, that believes that the Bible is the Word of God and was written by apostles, for example, there's a very problematic approach with that, mainly because we know a lot about the Bible and we have a lot of texts about the evolution of the Bible and aspects of the Bible that were added to the Bible. And if we see Bibles in a chronological way, and there's many Bibles, but if we follow lineages of specific Bibles, we see the additions in terms of the politics of the time and the subtractions. And but the part that was the basis of our conversation was the fact that we know from a lot of texts that most of the apostles couldn't read and write. So to believe that they wrote the Gospels. Of course, we live in a world where especially in the first world, where everybody knows to read and write. See? In the Egyptian period, there's an interesting definition of being able to be literate. And it's basically just being able to sign your name in documents. So a lot of people basically just memorize how to do it. And in some cases it's very interesting because as you see the evolution of documents of a scribe, that all he knows is to write his name. At some point, let's say at age 35, he makes a mistake. But because he's working through copying himself, the mistake keeps going until age 60, for example. See? So it's very interesting, because then, when we go back to the mandala, most people didn't know how to read or write, even the monks didn't. So to have in bas relief the life of the Buddha so that it can be explained as you walk around by a teacher is a very interesting thing. So this idea of buildings as a didactic tool in every single religion is very present, and the stupa is one of those. It's just, the reason I'm saying this is because at one level you can be the typical Buddhist or the typical Catholic or the typical Muslim and go to a mosque and think that they have a specific function. But then, if you want to go deeper, every single building, every single religious building is designed in every religion to give you more information if you know what you're looking for. So if you go to a Gothic church and you know how to read the symbology, you're going to get a great description of Catholicism. See? The same thing happens with the stupas. So all this stuff we're talking about is embedded in every single tanka and in every single stupa if you know what you're looking for. The purpose of these things is not for them to look good. They're really books with the paths to enlightenment, every single one of them. That is why in Buddhism, as you progress through the path, you start taking certain vows that are designed to prevent you from behaving in specific ways that are negative in terms of karmic accumulation. And there's a bodhisattva vow that says to take... actually, it also appears in lower vows in a different take. But it's this idea that you are going to accept any representation of the Buddha, the Dharma, or the Sangha, regardless of their quality, as if they were the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha, in terms of the tools that can take you to enlightenment. Which is very tricky, because like the Dalai Lama is going to be here in a week, and there's posters of him everywhere, and postcards everywhere, and they're all over the floor. And you're supposed to take those and treat them as anything you would have in the altar. See? Because if they're done properly, and maybe a postcard is not, but maybe it is, see? If they're done properly, if you've been taught how to read them, they will take you through all of this, see? So, that's always very interesting. Jesus did know how to write, by the way. There's a lot of... if... You might not remember it by exactly... where, but in John is my favorite gospel because it's incredibly esoteric. And the beginning of John is very interesting. The beginning of John was added by a really beautiful poet. It's beautiful poetry that never, it doesn't appear, the stuff he talks about doesn't appear again in John. But it starts with this story about these guys wanted to try to trick Jesus. And they came to him and they said to him, this woman is an adulteress. And in Moses, in the Old Testament, Moses said that adulterers need to be stoned to death. And they're trying to trick him by saying, should we let her go or should we kill her? You know? And if he lets her go, then he's not following the Old Testament. So it generates a problem that his opponents can use to attack him on. And if he kills her, he has no compassion, and his whole teaching is about love and compassion. So then he goes against himself. And it's this beautiful, beautifully set up thing where he says, he doesn't answer quickly, and he starts writing on the ground. And in the Bible, in the one we use, a lot of chunks of this story have been taken out. That is where he says, those who have not sinned be the ones to cast the first stone. And by saying that, he washes his hand of the whole problem, because no one on the group that has brought this woman forth has not sinned. So only if they have not, they could be ethically allowed to follow to the letter Moses' precepts, no? And so they let her go, basically. And before he leaves, Jesus tells her, but don't sin again, accepting that what she did was a sin, see? It's a very weird story because it has a lot of problems. I mean, it's like a lot of these little stories, it's meant to convey that nice story, no? But there's a lot of holes in it if we really think about it. The first hole is that if she was an adulterer, the person she had relations with should have also been brought to be judged under the same law. And he's not there. See? So it's kind of interesting. But then what the hell was Jesus writing on the ground? See, there's another text which is where this was stolen from. It doesn't appear until about 200 after Christ. So the earlier takes on John don't have this beginning. And that beginning is where he also says, Jesus is first was the Word, and the Word is God. See? Which is a very interesting thing, but we won't get into that because the whole point here is information. No? In the full poem, he writes on the ground the sins of everybody that's there. Mm-hmm. And when they see that he can read their minds, mm-hmm. they let it be. Mm-hmm. See? I don't know why that didn't make it into the Bible. It's just left. I mean, what the hell was he writing? No? But he was writing. And because of little things like that, we know that Jesus actually could read and write. There's a lot of those little things all through. But we know out of the same texts and the same information that Peter and his brother were illiterate, for example. That Luke was illiterate. So how come he has a gospel? See? So it's something to think about. But at the same time, then we get information in different ways. So the fourth bumi is the bumi called the radiant. Of course, if I didn't say it before, once you see emptiness directly, when you come out of seeing emptiness directly, one of the things you have is bodhicitta, which makes you a bodhisattva. See? So then there's something to think about there. Can you be a bodhisattva before you see emptiness directly?
When you need a realization of bodhicitta.
But you get it.
Oh.
Uh-huh.
So you must have some underlying bodhicitta in the third scope where you see emptiness directly.
What if we said that, and I'm not certain of this, this is just my way of thinking right now about that point, but what if we say that what you get is the uncontrived realization of the wish for bodhicitta? An uncontrived realignment of the neural pathways towards wanting that frame of mind that we've understood intellectually up to that point through the other scopes. So it's just a thought. It's not necessarily correct. So we are a bodhisattva when we're in these bhumis. And at this level, the bodhisattva is cultivating the perfection of effort and eliminating afflictions. Something interesting about this bhumi, let's see. Look at that Tsongkhapa over there. What's around his head?
He's got a halo.
He's got a halo. And all the saints have a halo. And why the hell do they have halos? I mean, at some point they were misrepresented in the Renaissance for the little ring that angels wear on top of their heads. But it's really light. This bhumi is called the radiant because through this perfection of effort, the bodhisattva constantly emits the radiance of exalted wisdom. So in all those theological texts, when we're talking about some sage and they say, well, he kind of glows, they are for sure at least at this level. And the important thing here is that this process is not meant to be understood just in terms of Buddhism. This process is the process that anybody with a spiritual path on the search for their version of enlightenment goes to. See? So all these levels have to be attained by anybody looking for illumination. And if you are a geek, you can go into other spiritual texts and start finding what terminology is used by other religions to talk about the same processes. Sometimes you will find that three or four steps are skipped, but when you go deeper, you find that actually they're just subcategories of a step. They're just doing it differently, but the level of realizations seems to be very scientific. It seems that it's a mathematical equation, it's a formulaic process directly correlating certain behaviors with neural pathway transformations that allow for this thing called karma, or whatever we want to call it, to allow for the evolution of behavior towards a specific goal. See? So, you start glowing. And not because you've been hanging near radioactivity. At this stage, this wisdom, the practice of this perfection of effort will burn up the afflictive obstructions to omniscience. Because your meditations are incredibly deep, at this level, as a result, you get a very powerful version of mental pliancy, which you also start getting at the fourth level of meditation, and at the sixth, and at the eighth. Okay? But this is a lot deeper. We're talking in the previous bhumis, we stop dealing with afflictions that were of a gross nature. And in reality, after the first bhumi, most of the afflictions that we're dealing with are of a subtle nature. So because we're dealing with subtle afflictive states of mind, and it's very important to understand this in the larger picture. Until we see emptiness directly, we're dealing with gross afflictions. After the first bhumi, we're dealing with subtle afflictions, which means that gross afflictions don't have power over us. Which means that we're dealing with the makeup of the negative states of mind. Which means that we're very close to enlightenment. Which means that every bhumi we go through, it's harder and harder to revert to a previous state of mind. Okay? So, we get mental pliancy in a very, very deep way. When you start studying meditation, they give you antidotes for distraction, antidotes for laziness, and stuff like that. At this level, we're dealing with the subtle aspects of that laziness that we've never dealt with before. Every time we deal with the subtle aspects of an afflictive state of mind, we have the potential of eradicating that state of mind fully, if we attain what we're working into. And that's what the bhumis are all about. So at this level then, we eliminate laziness and increase the ability to practice meditation for extended periods of time. And when we say extended periods of time, we mean a lot of time. I mean, right now, if you get to stage 4 on the practice of meditation, you can do 3 hours no problem. So here we're talking full days of meditational practice. You destroy rooted afflictions and cultures. So we destroy rooted afflictions. When we deal with the subtle types of the affliction, we're taking the roots out. We're not dealing with the plant that is above the ground. We're unrooting the afflictions. And when we are able to do that, then the affliction ceases to produce any type of reaction on us. This is a very tricky thing, because until we have renunciation, Buddhism is very problematic. I mean, I know it's presented in a very uppity way in the West. But basically what Buddhism, until we have renunciation, is saying is not something we want to hear. It's saying love, the way we experience love, is a distraction. Friendship, the way we experience friendship, is a distraction. Joy, the way we experience joy, is a distraction. All those things we strive in normal culture, in our society, for are distractions. It's normally misunderstood as, why would I want to be a Buddhist if what it's requiring of me is to be neutral about everything? And that's a misconception. But it's a misconception that is very rooted in truth. Because until you get renunciation, you don't understand. We still want to be happy with our partners and to be happy with our kids. See? So somebody that has not gone through that process and been incredibly depressed, all the scopes, all those uncontrived realizations have a side effect of incredible depression when you have those uncontrived realizations. They're not joyous moments. They're moments of understanding, and understanding is really sad. Of course, there's an undertone of happiness later in the fact that you've attained understanding that will stop you from suffering in specific ways. But you know you've had an uncontrived realization because of incredible sadness, of the awareness of this stuff that we're talking about. Right now, we want to be Buddhists, but we want to, have our cake and eat it too? Something like that. And a lot of people don't really spend much time in what we're talking about, in the fact that we need to swim against the current. We need to stop. We really need to practice renunciation by detaching ourselves from not only the things that hurt us, but also the things that makes us happy. And the only way that's going to happen is by that understanding of impermanence. See, it's all linked up like a chain, it's a pyramid. By understanding impermanence, we understand that that happiness is actually a problem. It's hiding, it's distracting us from escaping the suffering. And it's not until we have problems and we suffer in major ways because we've lost happiness that we understand that that happiness is impermanent. See? So there's a progression that I'm trying to emphasize in terms of these paths. There's an evolution that has to happen in the mind. Buddhists call it karmic ripenings. But it's really an evolution of the transformation of neural pathways in a specific direction that require processes of transformation, ways of thinking about things differently. So one of the big problems is that we love to be able to say, oh yeah, I'm a Buddhist, ooh, the Dalai Lama rocks, but we get stuck at this level where we want, what is it? The cake and eat it too? It's not like that. What? How is it really?
Yeah.
We want our cake and we want... Okay. See, until we get the uncontrived realization of renunciation, we're not going to understand this properly. Something that happens here that we're not going to talk about, but so that I give the complete description. You destroy deeply rooted afflictions and cultivate the 37 harmonies with awakening. There is no point in going through 37 harmonies if we're not going to go deeply into them. So maybe later you will find out what that means. Through training these 37 practices, the Bodhisattva develops a type of meditative absorption that he's never had before, and cultivates wisdom. What does that do? The meditative absorption at this level and the cultivation of wisdom start weakening the remnant of this artificial and innate conception of true existence. So a bodhisattva in the fourth bhumi still has an innate conception of true existence. And that's a very important thing to understand. So the fifth bhumi. The fifth bhumi is called the difficult to cultivate bhumi. And it's called that because it has practices within it that are incredibly hard to achieve. And they require a huge amount of effort to perfect. And this is a little clue here on that chain, that linkage that we're talking about. You were perfecting effort before because you need that perfection of effort to fulfill this bhumi. Sometimes it's also called the difficult to overcome. Mainly because when you have attained this level, when you have completed the training on this level, one has profound wisdom and insight that are difficult to surpass or undermine. Nagarjuna explains it as follows. The fifth is called extremely difficult to overcome, since all evil ones find it extremely hard to conquer. Since all evil ones, meaning all mental afflictions, find it extremely hard to conquer him, mainly meaning the bodhisattva. He becomes skilled in knowing the subtle meaning of the noble truths and so forth. So the first turning of the will gets understood. At this level, a bodhisattva cultivates the perfection of samadhi. They develop incredible powers of meditative stabilization and overcome tendencies towards distraction. Again, we're talking about a subtle type of distraction. They achieve mental one-pointedness and perfect calm abiding. They also fully penetrate the meaning of the two truths, meaning conventional and ultimate. They perceive all phenomena as empty, transient, and prone to suffering.
Didn't they see that before? As empty and permanent and prone to suffering.
Yes, but to what level of depth is always the question we need to ask ourselves here. It's very important that they refer to the three together here, because as we said before, our school has a tendency to see emptiness directly through emptiness. But at that level, other schools do it to transientness, and other ones through the capacity of suffering of sentient beings. No? The sixth bhumi is called the manifest. And it's at this level where the bodhisattva clearly perceives the workings of dependent origination or dependent arising. And we're going to drop something you haven't heard before here. At this level, the bodhisattva directly understands singlelessness. In Tibetan, it's called Mshangma Medpa. In Sanskrit, it's called Animita, with a double T. So this is my definition of singleness. Singleness refers to the fact that phenomena seem to possess their apparent qualities by way of their own nature. But when one examines this appearance, one realizes that all qualities are mainly mentally imputed and not a part of the nature of the objects they appear to characterize. So what is singleness? Yes. Why is it called singlelessness?
It's singlelessness.
Singlelessness.
Should I?
I'll go. Sorry.
Okay.
Is it working already? Okay. So the result of this is that the bodhisattva manifests meditative wisdom. and they avoid attachment to cyclic existence or nirvana. So because of that, a bodhisattva at this level can attain nirvana.
That's the next thing?
No, it happens in this bhumi. Yeah, that's an attainment here.
That's something we haven't heard before either.
Yes. Because they're bodhisattvas, they decide to remain in the world in order to benefit other sentient beings. So they attain nirvana, but they decide to stay. And they start working on perfecting the perfection of wisdom. And through this, they perceive all phenomena as lacking inherent existence, as being like a dream and illusions, reflections, blah, blah, blah. And something really important at this level is that all notions of I and other are transcended. Along with the conceptions of existence and non-existence. So basically at this level, then the bodhisattva has attained all this, and all they do is abide in a contemplation of emptiness, of suchness. But at this level, because of their attainments, their mind is understood, is undisturbed by false ideas. So they're actually having a correct, through their perfecting the perfection of wisdom, they're having a correct understanding, philosophically speaking, of emptiness. Well, you got it when you saw emptiness directly, but because at the moment you see emptiness directly, you're not in a conceptual state of mind. Any idea you had up till this moment is a lot higher than before, but it's incorrect. Okay? So there is still here needs to be an evolution to clean obstructions. That's what the bhumis are. Evolutions through repetition to clean obstructions. It's just that because of the level they're in, every single thing they're doing is a perfection of that thing we were doing before. But see, it's still the same as in meditation, the same as with any teaching that is problematic. It's repetition to generate neural pathways aligning themselves to understand. Okay? So that's where we're going to leave it today. Do you have any questions? Oh. Yeah, it's a little...
We spent about 4 months describing the stages.
Yes.
How would you describe this set of stages to be different, or the stages of
everything we talked about before, except the meditational ones, mm-hmm. including the meditational ones, are the stuff that needs to be done when we are in no scope. So in stage zero, everything we've ever talked about is the information necessary to get the stuff at stage zero to move into stage one of the first three stages before we see emptiness directly, so that then we can do these 10 stages we're talking about. Mm-hmm. So basically, this right now is not of much use to us outside of painting a philosophical map so that we understand what needs to be worked at in a generic way, so that we go back to stage zero and work on those things. Mm-hmm. The reason we're doing this at this stage is because really because I'm about to finish, I have my last term in the monastery in June, and we're supposed to be finishing, and it's always presented, oh, so you're so special now that you've finished. But all I've discovered in my personal experience is that I have more questions, and I think I know less than I've ever known in terms of the Dharma. And one of the things I don't understand is a concise path to enlightenment. So we made a parenthesis here in which I've been working on what that concise path is, because it's never taught in a simplistic way. And when it's taught, it's the Lamrim, which takes 3 years to go through. So right now we're going through this process as an answer to my own personal need to figure out where I am and what needs to be done by myself. And this problem I'm seeing around me, where people are thinking they're special and thinking that they are in very advanced levels when we're not, when a lot of work needs to be done. And because of that misconception, a lot of time is being wasted on things that are not necessarily the ones we should be doing right now, the ones that are appropriate to our level. No? So that's where that is coming from.
Mm. Have you plotted yourself?
I'm no scope. No, I'm in zero. Mm-hmm. I mean, one of the distinctions is that you have to have shamatha to be able to move through, or a non-contrived realization of death and impermanence. Mm-hmm. And the way I am defining a non-contrived realization, I haven't had them yet. Mm-hmm. The way some other people define non-contrived, not necessarily the Dalai Lama, is a lot easier. And I have a tendency for my own safety to go for the hard ones, not the easy ones. Mm-hmm. So... Okay.